cue that we give to the folks in the tape ministry to turn on the machine to tape it, right? So they're assumedly taping now. This is a session about Emily Dickinson, and to come right to those handouts on the table, I have written some about Emily Dickinson. I have written a weekly column for the local newspaper in Seattle, and occasionally I devote a column to Emily Dickinson or something related to her. So those are some that I have written about her, and if you're interested, you might take one to there's a picture of me on each one. You can throw darts at it. It's very good kind of target practice for that sort of thing. Or you can even read them and share them with the others of your acquaintances who are also interested in poetry or Emily Dickinson. The other hand out there is a series of poems from which I will be doing some work with you. None of these is essential by any means, and if you do take them, you might share them. As you know, at Holden, we are always very conscious of not using a lot of paper, wasting paper. So we try not to have hundreds of sheets of paper for each teacher, which then just adds to the basic problem that Holden Village is trying hard to work the other way against, that is to say, cut down on waste of forests and paper. So take them as you wish and share them if you would. My interest in Emily Dickinson started essentially when I majored in American literature at Dartmouth College. And I had a teacher who was very enthusiastic about Emily Dickinson, and his enthusiasm rubbed off on me. And as a result of that work, I subsequently found myself being president of and teaching in a small college, Berkshire Community College, quite close to where Emily Dickinson lived in Massachusetts. And so I immediately started to teach Emily Dickinson's poetry and used to try to take my students as often as I could over to her house and visit the place where she lived and worked and the town in which her family was the predominant family. Her grandfather was in effect the founder of Amherst College, first class liberal arts college. And her brother succeeded her father as treasurer of the college. Between them, they put in about 40 years as treasurer of Amherst College, which was the chief administrative officer of the college in those days, the president being largely an academic leader. The town is one of my favorites in the whole world. She is my favorite poet. I think she's the best poet that America has produced. I always wince a little when somebody says that she's the greatest woman poet that we've produced, because I don't think the question is germane as to whether she's male or female. She is the best that we've produced. That's my own view, and I'll take on anybody here who would like to take that view. I think she's that good. So I've taught her a lot, and I love to come to Holden Village, and every other summer or so I try to concentrate my efforts on Emily Dickinson's poetry. I've also done Robert Frost's poetry here, which I have enjoyed doing as well. So that's the basic background. I did a doctorate at the University of Massachusetts, which is also in Amherst, so I've been practically a native of Amherst, or so I like to think of myself, just the way I like to think of myself as a native of Holden Village. You don't have to live here year-round or for years on end to feel that it's your place. And that's the way I feel about Holden Village, and that's the way I feel about Emily Dickinson's hometown of Amherst. The sources that I'm going to use are essentially those poems in the handout there, which I have a copy here, and a text which is available in the Holden Village bookstore. That's a plug, and you are welcome to buy it. It is the best anthology of her poem, the best selections of her poetry. There is a full volume of all of her poems in one volume, which I also have, and I was going to bring it down here tonight, but it got too cluttered to bring along everything I wanted to bring along. But this is the best selection that I know by the same editor, Thomas H. Johnson, and his version is not perceived as being the authoritative version of her poetry. And I recommend the book to you if you become interested, if you become bitten, as I have been bitten by the bug of Emily Dickinson's poetry. I have myself an earlier version of the same book, and I must say it's kind of interesting to look at the price. I bought this when it first came out in the 60s for $1.95. It'll cost you $10 in the Holden Village bookstore, but it's exactly the same book with the same pagination, the same introduction, etc. So those will be the sources. Notice that sometimes you will have the poems before you and sometimes you won't have the poems before you. And that's by design. I would not want you always to have the poem in front of you, because I think part of the charm of sharing poetry and of trying to appreciate poetry is to hear it. Hear it. It should be heard. Poets write to be heard. It should be coming in through the ear, and the words need to have the sound in order to have the full effect. Some of her poems are tightly written. Concision was part of her bag of tricks. She was extremely concise, using few words, very spare. And therefore, sometimes it takes a couple of readings for us to fully comprehend what it was that she's getting at, and we'll do some of that. We'll be reading every poem that we deal with, we'll read before we deal with it. I want to be sure that although I've got this series of presentations about her poetry and talks about her poetry, sharing back and forth with you about her poetry, I want to be sure that you feel free to have any questions or comments or requests at any time, because I do have a plan, but it's a viable plan. It's not a plan that can't be changed. The overall plan is to work this week with 5 sessions on her poems, taking the first 2 today and tomorrow to talk about her nature poetry, and then on Wednesday talking about her poems dealing with God. Then on Thursday, talking about her love poetry, and finally her poems related to immortality. But this is a flexible program, and she wrote on so many disparate things that you can't get, even with that rather broad series of 5 headings, 4 headings with nature coming twice, there is the need to branch off every once in a while. So it's not tight, but it gives us a certain order. So let's take a look at some of the poems, and let's start off with some fairly simple ones. I'd like to refer first to a couple that refer to her ambivalence about whether she should have her poems published. And maybe if you've got this, you might share it. Does anybody have the book? I don't think that anybody does have the book at this point. If you're interested and you want to get the book and have it for subsequent sessions, it will be moderately helpful. This is the first the poem that I'm looking at here is the very first poem that is on the first page. Would anybody like to read that for us? I'm Nobody, Who Are You? Thank you.
I'm Nobody, Who Are You? Are you Nobody, too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell, they'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog. To tell one's name, the livelong June, to an admiring bog.
Good, thank you. Thank you. You read it very well indeed. The thing that I like about this poem as a starter is that it does indeed, it seems to me, get at the heart of her ambivalence about her poetry. She knew how good she was. She knew that she had a genius for writing poetry. And yet she was a retiring New England spinster, young woman, and then middle-aged lady. And she wasn't sure at all that she wanted to be up there in front and have her name sound of the livelong June to an admiring bog. So this poem gets that ambivalence about her attitude across. It also gets a lot of the play and the fun of her poetry right up front. It's a very accessible poem. It's very, you get right away what she's after, and yet it has some nice humor, some nice kind of self-deprecating humor, which is part of her humor often, and it has a kind of a little bite about those of us who may be different and aspire to fame, even on a modest level. She has a very sharp knife for people that she thinks deserve some scorn. The second poem in that list is a lot the same kind of thing. But let's take a look at the third one on that list, if we may. The third one on page one. This is My Letter to the World. Somebody want to try that one? Go ahead. Thank you.
This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. The simple news that nature told with tender majesty. Her message is committed to hands I cannot see. For love of her, sweet countrymen, judge tenderly of me.
Well, further, thank you very much. Nicely read. A further amplification of her ambivalence on this important subject, that she wasn't sure she wanted to publish her poems. She wasn't sure she wanted the fame, modest fame as it might have been, as she perceived it in her tiny town of Amherst, Massachusetts. But on the other hand, she felt that she wanted some of her thoughts to get across, and she would, in spite of being ignored by the world never wrote to her, but she would, through her poems, which may or may not ever get seen, in her view, she did want to tell what she knew about nature, what nature had meant to her. She wanted to share it, and that's one of the first purposes in her poetry, was to get across her views on nature. There's another one that I want to move into, which gets directly to another aspect of her humor. Let's take a look at page six, if those of you who have the poems. At the top of that page, there's a nice one, which I would again like to ask somebody to read if they would like to undertake it. Be I'm expecting you. Somebody want to try that? Somebody who's not read or somebody who has read? It's kind of fun to share the reading. Why don't I do this one rather than always calling on you to do the hard work, all right? B, I'm expecting you, was saying yesterday to someone you know that you were due. The frogs got home last week, are settled and at work. Birds, mostly back. The clover, warm and thick. You'll get my letter by the 17th. Reply. Or better, be with me. Yours, fly. Now the season is obviously spring. You get a whole lot of information just in the interstices of the poem itself. And things are coming back. They're leaving now. They're leaving now, and indeed one of the things I want us to be registering with at some point along here is some of her poems about this time of year. But in this one we have people, we have all kinds of creatures, birds, insects, coming back, returning. And so this is a wonderful kind of a little fey bulletin from one type of insect to another type of insect saying, hey, where are you? We're all here. We're here at Holden Village waiting for the people to come so we can bother them. Where are you? You should be coming back and joining us as well. Okay, let's take a look at the next one after the bee. A bird came down the walk. Somebody want to try that one? I realize it's not always easy when you're coming at it fairly cold, but on the other hand, these are fairly accessible and I think can be read. Would you? Thank you.
A bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass, and then hopped sidewise to the wall to let a beetle pass. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head like one in danger. Cautious, I offered him a crumb, and he unrolled his feathers and rode him softer home than oars divide the ocean. Too silver for a seam, or butterflies off banks of noon, leap plashless as they swim.
Good, thank you very much. What kind of bird do you think that is?
Anybody have an idea what kind of bird that might be?
Yeah, it's got a good chance of being a robin.
Sounds like a robin, doesn't it? Yeah, good. That's what I've always visualized it at. I don't know if I'm right. But it sounds like a robin, doesn't it? Just the way he's behaving. The way they behave in the lawns around here, and that's the way they behave around the lawns in Amherst, Massachusetts, I assure you, and probably did exactly the same way in 1849 or so when she wrote this poem. Now this poem has an interesting kind of switch that it makes. Can anybody see where this poem takes a different route? Where it starts to change from the way it starts off? Is there a point where that occurs, do you think?
Yeah, after the word crumb.
After which word?
Crumb.
Crumb.
It seemed that's seemed where it changed. It was factual. It was describing a bird clearly, yeah. And
yeah.
Then immediately after that it goes into...
Yeah. Oh, that certainly is a point where there is a switch. I think there may be another. Is there another switch that somebody sees maybe a little bit earlier?
Where he glanced with rapid eyes.
Yeah, it seems to me there it switches too. For one thing, well, there are a lot of things that change. For one thing, just the meter changes. Just the sing-song rhythm of the first. Let me just go through it again quickly and see if you get that switch. A bird came down the walk, he did not know I saw. He bit an angle worm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And then he drank a dew from a convenient grass, and then hopped sidewise to the wall to let a beetle pass. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. He stirred his velvet head like one in danger, cautious. I offered him a crumb, and he unrolled his feathers and rowed him softer home. Then oars divide the ocean to silver for a seam, or butterflies off banks of noon leap, plashless as they swim. See, we've got a different meter, we've got a different rhyme scheme. In the first part, we've got very obvious rhymes, direct rhymes, walk and saw and raw, walk and halves, very close. Dew, then he drank a dew. Grass and pass. The rhyme scheme is much more direct. And then you see we start to switch in the last three verses to a more oblique rhyme. It's an indirect rhyme. It's not exact rhyme, it's an approximation. So it takes on a kind of a more thoughtful tone. It seems to me what she's done here is to start off just describing a robin, because I agree that that's what the bird might very well be. You might say it's something else. There are other kinds of birds that peck at killdeer do also, if you see them on the grass sometimes. But robins...
The first line sounds more like a robin.
Came down the walk. It does. You can see him coming down the walk, sort of taking over the yard, right? Thinks it's his yard. You and I know it's ours, but he thinks it's his. But then all of a sudden, we're into the bird's own world, his own psyche. And we're dealing with, it seems to me, a kind of sense of the terror that all creatures like birds, wild birds, live with every day. That you and I, most of us, for most of the time, don't have to share. That robin's got to be aware every minute that there may be a hawk coming after him, or a dog, or a cat. And the caution, the tension is there. Yeah. He glanced with rapid eyes that hurried out all around. They looked like frightened beads, I thought. he's like one in danger. He's cautious. And then when he sees something approaching, even though the approach is benign with a crumb, he takes off. And then the description of his taking off is just wonderfully dramatic as he heads out. Any other comments about this switch or this poem? We're getting into now a little more serious view of the way nature works. It's not, she's by no means a children's poet in the sense that she doesn't want to deal with the tough, harsh world of danger and the possibility of pretty quick death if the bird doesn't exercise great care, and we all who have cats know how often that happens. Any other thoughts about it? I don't want to monopolize the discussion by any means.
It'd be quite deep for children. I mean,
yeah, I think that the third three verses would be pretty tough for little mm-hmm. children to know what they were getting at. I don't think, though, that it's... I never think that her poetry is such that a child who is curious about it shouldn't read it, because Bruno Bettelheim and others are telling us that mm-hmm. that what kids need is a pretty direct contact with reality, and indeed that in fairy stories, that one of the worst things that we can do is to take out the really, what we perceive as being too horrendous for children. Mm-hmm. We've stripped fairy tales of their real blood and their real energy for young kids by taking the witches out and taking the death out and the danger out. So I think that kids are a lot more capable of dealing with those things than we often consider them to be. But they would have trouble. This is not a very accessible poem. And I think a little kid...
Well, they probably, they'd see the picture, but not like we would see it.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's right. I think they would... But I bet they'd recognize pretty quickly if we took them through it, and I've never done it with this particular poem. I think they would see quickly that there is that in the robin. There is that fright, because they can frighten. Even little, tiny kids can frighten the robin. They kind of like to do it. There's a kind of a savage quality of that glee on the part of a kid to chase a robin, as you probably have seen, as I have. Okay. Let's take a look at the previous one on page 5. So some of you who haven't got this might want to share it. Do you want to try this one for us?
A narrow fellow in the grass occasionally rhymes. You may have met him, did you not? His notice sudden is. The grass devises with a comb, a spotted shaft is seen, and then it closes at your feet and opens further on. He likes a boggy acre, a floor too cool for corn. Yet when a boy and barefoot, I more than once at noon have passed, I thought, a whiplash, a braiding in the sun. When stooping to secure it, it wrinkled and was gone. Several of nature's people, I know and they know me. I feel for them a transport of cordiality. But never met this fellow, attended or alone, without a tighter breathing and zero at the bone.
Good, thank you very much. Nicely read. What is the creature, do you think, we're dealing with here?
Snake.
Snake. Mm-hmm. Almost certainly a snake, don't you agree? Here again, we've got a description, a beautiful description of the way a snake moves. He occasionally rides on the grass. His notice sudden is, the grass divides as with a comb. I love that line. That's the way it is with a snake going through the grass. You just see it dividing. A spotted shaft is seen, and then it closes at your feet and opens farther on. And then a description of what kind of a creature it is. But then again, we get the personal reaction to the snake, describing it and describing the way it makes the poet feel. And the way the snake makes the poet feel is in a series of metaphors. Never met this fellow attended or alone without a tighter breathing and zero at the bone. What about that zero? What do you think that zero
cold
is?
Chill.
Chill, kind of chill. Anything else? Zero at the bone. Chill. Anything else that it could be? Zero? The bone? I've asked this question of classes over the years. And if I keep pressing, we don't have time. I have more time than that. I keep pressing for different interpretations of that zero. I've kept a record of what I've got. Okay, shall I tell you what students have given me from time to time? First one is always temperature, cold. Well, zero temperature, cold. Then, a student one time said, there's a sensation at the marrow of the bones. The marrow of the bones, not necessarily cold, it's a sensation. The marrow of the bones. Next, a weakness which suggests there are no bones. There's zero bone. I don't have any knee bones. You know, I feel that I'm gonna maybe collapse. I don't have any. I've got jelly in there. You ever been so frightened that you're actually afraid you're gonna fall down? And then no feeling at all. Zero at the bones. Zero feeling. All of a sudden I'm numb. I'm totally numb. I'm so frightened. And finally, and here's the one that I really liked best of all. It reflects on the second one that I gave you. That's a bone in section, student said. Put it on the board and said, that's a bone in section, if you look at a bone. So I feel that the shape of the bone is the zero, that the bones are misbehaving and are not supporting me as they ought to do. So that shows you what a metaphor like that from college students can elicit. And that's part of the fun of poetry, is that you can take a metaphor, which, what did Emily Dickinson mean by this? What did she mean by zero at the bone? Who knows? Who knows what she meant? Did she mean cold? Did she mean cold feet? You ever had cold feet, by the way? Really cold feet? Really cold feet? You know, I don't know that I've ever had cold feet.
You ought to come to Minnesota then someday. We'll show you cold weather.
It's a different kind of cold feet, Howard. I'll tell you how I first realized that my sense of cold feet wasn't what it has always been, which is essentially what you're saying. When you say, somebody says to you, have you got cold feet? What's the matter? Why won't you fight me? You've got cold feet? You know, a kid in the schoolyard. A friend of mine who's also a bird watcher was in Mexico riding on a bus, and somebody on the bus switched his knapsack for the other knapsack, and the other knapsack contained marijuana, having heard something about a trap up ahead. So the fellow was trapped with a knapsack which had marijuana in it, and when he was apprehended and was going to go to jail, ever spend any time in a Mexican jail? I haven't either. But he knew what they were like. And when the police chief who was taking him to the jail saw that it was his knapsack, he said to him, we're going to make you wish you were dead. And he said his feet got so cold that he really had to hold himself up against the wall because his feet were so cold by the terror of what he said. He almost died in jail, by the way, and I was helpful with his other friends in getting him out. But the point I'm making is that cold feet of the sort that we're speaking about, which a snake could make you feel like, especially if you were a little kid barefoot walking through and saw a snake, has all the powerful connotations of that metaphor. I want to say, just because I don't want to forget it, that I wrote a column about an experience that I had. I do some writing with a brother of mine who is a lawyer. And he told me one time that he was preparing to teach a course in legal drafting. Any lawyers here? Legal drafting, as he explained it to me, is where you're going to write a bill, which is going to become law, the major purpose of which in your writing effort is to be absolutely and utterly crystal clear, so there may be no ambiguity. So that if I read it, and you read it, and she reads it, and person with an entirely different background, but knowing English reads it, the understanding is going to be exactly the same. There is no possibility for ambiguity. And I said to him, that's interesting that you're preparing to teach that course, because I'm preparing to go up to Holden Village and teach Emily Dickinson that next summer. And so I'm going to be teaching a course which is exactly the opposite. See, because what I'm going to teach is a course where a word like zero at the bone can be subject to myriad interpretations. So poetry is the opposite of legal drafting. And I said, you ought to talk to your students about this so that they'll know what they're trying to do, and I'll talk to my students about what you're teaching, and maybe there'll be a kind of a link here. So I wrote a column about that. That's one of these here. And I used this exact metaphor of zero at the bone because it seems to me as good an example as I've come across of how metaphor, one thing standing for another, and maybe standing for a number of others at different levels of understanding, can be a fascinating way of expanding our vocabularies and understanding of what goes on in the world. They say that anthropologists are telling us these days that farther than this, when men learned to say those comparisons and talk in the very rudimentary forms of metaphors, it was the biggest leap forward that man had ever made mentally after he or she stood up, so that the hands would be free and the eyes could come forward and the hands could start to be used. Metaphor was the biggest jump.
Your statement is zero to the bone. You say there are a number of interpretations. It's true.
Yeah.
But the interpretation is fear. They all lead to the same thing.
Yes. Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
So there is no misunderstanding when you come right down to it.
Well, but the subtleties in this law that you and I are now drafting, if we're in a legal drafting course, must go beyond the very first primary meaning here. We've got to go into the subtleties so that everybody will understand it exactly the same way. And fear, yeah, but now if we get into what was the manifestation of the fear which resulted in the other person acting in such and such a way, then we're into an area where we've got to be... We can't be using metaphors. I see your point, it's well taken. But the subtleties of language can be terribly important to get them out when you have a legal drafting.
I see, okay. I see you've been around a bit. You always end with a stroke.
Okay. Okay, I'd like to do a couple, to have us discuss a little bit, a couple that are not specifically nature poems, so that we're not going to get into a rut with nature poems. I'd like to have us look at one which is on page 2 of these handouts. It is the bottom one. Yes. I'll give this to you. Would you be ready? Would you be willing to read it for me? I'll give it to you if you read it.
Okay.
Read it aloud, would you?
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell a definition so clear of victory as he defeated, dying, on whose forbidden ear the distant strains of triumph burst agonized and clear.
Okay. What does this poem say? Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend the nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear victory as he defeated dying on whose forbidden ear. I'm not sure how this version reads. There are several versions of it. How does it read, the last line?
The distant strains of triumph burst agonized and clear.
Agonizing. Burst agonizing clear, she first wrote.
Agonized.
Yeah. So what's the basic thing that's being commented on here?
Well, my success could mean that somebody else stumbled.
Yeah, and to whom is the event more significant?
Person who doesn't succeed.
Yeah, who understands what success means more? The person who succeeds or the person who doesn't succeed? Did you ever have the experience of wanting something a lot, then you get it, and then you say, why the heck did I want this so much? It's weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable once you get it. You wanted it. Sir?
Bob Dylan has in one of his songs, he has this quote that there's no success like failure, and failure's no success at all.
Uh-huh.
It's that same kind of thing.
Same kind of thing, exactly, yeah. Yeah. How do you react to the use of the soldier who was trying to get the goal and dies in the unsuccessful attempt? Do you agree that he probably understands success a lot better than the person who has indeed on the other side achieved the victory? The person who achieves the victory, after all, is probably just going to go on and get another assignment to go and take another target, right? I mean, that's the way the world works. By the nature of human endeavors, once you achieve something, you're immediately faced with another goal. And if you're not, you're probably not a happy person. Maybe that's too American. Maybe that's too capitalistic to say. Maybe it's too driven. Maybe I'm too much the product of my own society. But certainly in our society, the goals need to be constantly restated, redefined. As we achieve one thing, we need to go on and achieve another thing. I often say to students of mine who succeed with some degree of distinction, aha, now you've shown you can do it, now everybody's going to expect you to do it from now on. It's true, it's true. You have a student who's getting A minuses and B pluses, and then he slips down or she slips down to a C, which might have been okay before. Say, why, Harold, for Pete's sake, you showed you can get a B plus, what's this C? That's the way we do things, for good or ill. And we all have that, in a measure, something of the gyroscope spinning that gives us the interior goals to say, I'm relatively close to God, I want to get closer to God, if it's religion. Or I scored a 95 in golf, now I want to break 90. And then I want to be playing the same way Jack Nicklaus plays. Constant goals before us in almost anything we do. So this poem, it seems to me, gets at that aspect of success. This was one of her earliest poems. This was one of the few poems that she had published during her lifetime. Her poetry wasn't known at all when she was a working poet. It was only after she died that her poems were published and known. And that's one of the great enigmas and one of the fascinating things about her life. By the way, I should be perfectly upfront about her. Not only do I think that she is the best poet that we produce, but I think she's incomparably the most fascinating woman that America has produced. And I think maybe I'd go stronger and say she's the most fascinating woman who ever lived. I just find her, how this person who was in effect most of her mature life a recluse, how could she know so much about the affairs of human beings? How could she know so much about life? Yeah.
What did she do for a living?
She was from a very well-to-do family.
Okay.
She did not, never worked. She'd never worked for money.
Yeah.
She stayed home. She took care of her mother. She did things that a 19th century American woman did around the household. And she wrote poetry. And she said, my business is to love. She had an enormous capacity for love, for her sister, for her brother, for her mother, for her father, for her friends. Most of her friends, though, in the latter part of her life, she didn't see.
And she never married.
She never married. So how could a woman, or anybody, woman or man, who set that kind of style of life for himself or herself, how could she know so much about the way the world works? To me, it's just a miracle that never ceases to enchant me. I find it one of the most fascinating conundrums. I've been rereading since I got up here. I brought along a bunch of biographies. This is one of them. This is one of the best ones, Emily Dickinson, an interpretative biography by Thomas Johnson, who is the same man who edited the Complete Poems. And then I've got several others with me also. I didn't bring them all along. I had to carry them all the way up the hill, that sort of thing, you know, so you can't take everything to Holden Village. But I've been reading today one that's the longest and fullest biography. There are a whole bunch of them because she fascinates lots of people. This is a two-volume biography, and I'm still rereading the first volume, which doesn't even deal with Emily Dickinson. It deals with her father, her mother, her grandfather, her sister, her friend, and then the second volume again in Emily Dickinson, just trying to figure out how this could possibly happen. In effect, that's what we're doing. How could this person have so much art and know so much in which to describe the incomparable art of the use of words, how men and women relate to each other, how families work, how governments work, how people adjust to death, how people relate to God. I mean, with God, she is just amazing. The central book in her life was the Bible. You know how she described the Bible? She said the Bible is a merry book. Think of that. The Bible is a merry book. She meant it. So then you have to say, well, what did Emily Dickinson mean? How do we figure that the Bible is a merry book? M-E-R-R-Y. Well, you could tackle the Bible just from that standpoint. Try to find out what in the world was she getting at. But you'd be able to give some examples, I bet. So, she had this endless fascination, and she could deal with success. How did she know this about success? How did she know? That's a terribly sophisticated insight. You got to be a soldier and go out and die in order to learn that, I would think.
Or read the Bible.
Or read the
Bible. It's all there.
Right?
Well, it seems to me if she said her business was to love, that would lead you into all this other stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, if you love people, this is what people do.
Yeah. Except isn't it possible to love without having quite such a profound understanding? I mean, there is a love that's an engaging and attractive love, but that's so accepting.
Well, it would seem like if she said that was her business, then her amount of love would be a little more than the average person.
Yeah, it's a very good observation. Yeah, I see what you're getting at. Yeah. So how did she know how to love that well? Where did she learn that? She didn't go out into the world and learn what loving results in, except with her own family, in effect. Let's take a look at one that has to do with not success, but failure. It's on page 3. Bottom one on page 3.
I'm sorry, I was not going to say it, but isn't her family enough that she has figured out, I mean, to understand in herself the relationship with them in that certain way?
Okay, but can you learn this from your family?
No, not exactly.
I want to read this one myself, and I want to tell you, see if you think that most people or anybody you know could learn this just from your family. Crumbling is not an instant's act. I'm in the middle of page 3, for those of you who are following. Crumbling is not an instant's act, a fundamental pause. Dilapidation's processes are organized decays. 'Tis first a cobweb on the soul, a cuticle of dust, a borer in the axis, an elemental rust. Ruin is formal, devil's work, consecutive and slow. Fail in an instant, no man did. Slipping is crash's law. Now that's a poem that I read when I first read it. It's not one of her best known poems or one of her poems that you find in anthologies often. But to me, when I first read that, I remembered her description of how she knows that something is poetry. She says, when I read something and it makes me feel as though the top of my head has been taken off, I know that's poetry. And that's something akin to what this made me feel. This is so full of insights about what happens when people fail, or industries fail, or businesses, or colleges, or Lutheran churches, or Catholic churches, or governments. This is the way it is. Or am I caca? I'm asking a lot of you, because I've read this poem 100 times. Maybe what I would like to do with this one is to for those of us who are going to be able to come back together, to have another opportunity to look at this and to come back and give some reactions to it. But I know that everybody isn't taking that particular route. But other observations on it right off the top? Is it that insightful? Is it that extraordinarily insightful to talk about? Hey, have you ever had the experience? One of the things that occurred to me was at this point brought a memory to me of a person that I had known who had been a pillar of society and a person who was a leader in every respect and who had everything. And all of a sudden, suicide. And we said, what in the world? How could that person of anybody in the world who had everything, including success, integrity, love, respect, that person commits suicide? Well, gradually, one learned about the degree to which it wasn't all as perfect as it seems to be. It never is, I guess, with the possible exception of Jesus Christ. We haven't had anybody in this world who's been as perfect as he, this person, this man, seemed to be. As we learned about what had been in his life, we learned that, yes, it was a seeping from within. Dilapidation's processes are organized decays. It hadn't been a snap, sudden thing, as we all thought. This is a terrible, sudden trauma. No. Things have been happening for a long time. And that's the way it is, really. From one standpoint point or another, physical, mental, spiritual, interpersonal relationships, flaws that aren't known, overcompensations, too much ambition, a monomania, I must have this, I must have success, and success is defined by the way society defines it, and therefore I'm going to appear to be a success in every way. Not a real thing, just an apparent thing. And all of a sudden the whole thing comes apart, and just the way this poem describes it to me. Any comments on it, or am I going too far?
Well, what it makes me think of is what happens when a relationship of any type crumbles. It's just this sort of thing. Relationships don't break like that.
Yeah.
It's a little time thing.
Yeah, relationships. Absolutely. That's Yeah. Courtships, for example, courtships. For those of us who can remember courtships, some people are young enough to be having courtships, but and I remember courtships that would start off with so much dazzle and affection, and then gradually there would be a misunderstanding and a glitch and a bad date and a whatever. And little by little, it would become clear that that wasn't going to work.
She used one of the metaphors there with regard to rust, which is something unusual. That's my pet field. It's corrosion. And it's one of the things that brought me up here was the water tank and the corrosion on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And didn't just start yesterday, did it?
Oh, no. In fact, is it started when they did something that they shouldn't have done.
Aha, a mistake, a bungle.
Yeah.
An error.
But the thing is that we, as a society, have put a monumental amount of energy into producing that metal.
Mm-hmm.
Out of nature.
Yeah.
And so all nature's doing is the natural thing, doing its darndest to get it back again.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so a good way to state it. Yeah.
And it fits in so well with many other things. You put a lot of energy into something that you really shouldn't have.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's going to be flawed.
Yeah.
Because entropy operates even on things that we make, entropy being the
yeah, but no, where did you find that one? You're supposed to be a poet.
Well, entropy is a word for poets. Entropy is the kind of word that Emily Dickinson might use, too. Yeah. Entropy, everybody know what entropy is? I'll try to define it, and then we'll have the engineer tell us what it really means. But entropy is the tendency on the part of every thing in the universe to disintegrate, to break down, to fall apart. And that the phenomenon of entropy takes place from the very initiation of the thing, whatever it be, and must therefore have countervailing forces which are positive forces, if that thing is to proceed, to continue, to exist, and to function, and perform, and simply to be. That
well, the entropy is unavailable energy. In other words, everything has reduced to the lowest energy state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that
yeah.
That's entropy. When it reaches a place where no more energy is available, then that's the entropy that is left.
And there is always a tendency to, for things to use the energy up.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the way I felt at 5:30 this morning when the alarm went off, and I thought, oh, is it already time to go over and get those coffee makers going? You know,
yeah.
Sort of like that must be like entropy. There's no more energy.
Right. And I suppose that we say with human beings, with respect to our bodies and our minds, not our spirits, we hope, we assume, but with our bodies and minds, that's the definition of death, really, isn't it? So there is no more energy. There's no more energy except, we hope, spiritual energy. Well, why don't we stop there, and those of you who can come back, maybe we'll have some insights about crumbling is not an instance act for us to take up tomorrow, and we'll also be talking about further nature poems, including one lovely one about a flower, which says that bloom is result, and that to be a flower is profound responsibility. Think about that. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You don't sound like a New Englander.
But I am. I can't deny it. Thank you so much.
Been a long time. Only had some of her poems, but none of these.
Yes. But she has wonderful things.
Yeah, there's some of them that show pictures. Kids all
yeah.
Like
yeah, yeah, she's wonderful. Things like, I remember a lot of children's books have, there is no frigate like a book to take us worlds away. And when kids are learning to read, that often is a metaphor that really grabs.
I'm Mark Adams, and my ancestors are carolled in there in Vermont, and the whole library there, the whole wing of one of the libraries there.
What the heck? Everest, Vermont, or
Middlebury? No, it's in it's down river.
The Concord River, Dartmouth?
Yeah, Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. They got a whole wing of the library there devoted to the Adamses.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I was a Dartmouth College graduate. Yes, so I know.
Once it's pointed out.
Yeah.
Well, now, I misunderstood. You said that you were at Governor College, is that, but it's at...
That's not.
You are?
That's not, yeah. In Washington. No, that's not Seattle.
I didn't miss it then.
No, that's right. That's right.
We're from Tacoma.
Who are you? Yeah.
Well, that's great.
So were you born out here? Are you a Washington person?
My dad came out in 1980 to Vermont, never went back. And I was born and raised over on the coast in Hopewell. And I've been back twice. Visited the family back there.
Yeah. It's great country. Great country, but I like it better out here myself. It's open and it's...
But if you want some good-looking Vermont country, get up between Shelton and Bremerton.
Uh-huh.
And that country there is so...
It's redolent.
Very much like it. It's the hardwood type of trees and the broadleaves.
Yes, I know the country you referred to. It is like Vermont and New Hampshire.
Well, thank you.
You're most welcome.
I agree. I don't think you would get this one stuff. Along with everything.
Yeah. How does she have it?
She's so almost reclusive.
How do you have it as if you're recluse? How do you learn that much about the way the world works? I mean, that poem is so chock full, and there are others that I share that have that same kind of amazing insight that if you've been out in the world operating, maybe you'll get one tenth of what she's got. She's just got that amazing insight.
Fire in the bone marrow. Well, anyway, my mother liked to write poetry, but it was kind of a just for fun.
I couldn't write poetry when I was.
Oh, but you know how to say it all.
Is she good saying it? She is good.
Sure. I'd write the first line, you know, and then they learned, you know, that there had to be a word at the end that would rhyme with the word in what I wrote. And they used to do quite good, but that's as much as I could do. I couldn't write a poem. Although I just love poetry. I sit and read it at home to myself.
It's hard. I can't write it either. I've tried, and that's very...
I have one book called Heart Throbs. It's a mixture of poetry. And I can sit there, cry over some of it, and read it out loud all by myself.
Yeah.
Well, that was interesting.
Thank you.
Yes.
Glad you enjoyed it.
Exciting.
I did too.
Sorry, I came in late because I missed a lot here, but...
No, you didn't miss that much.
Thank you.
Yes.
I don't know about your name, but I think of Irish. Is that somewhat?
Yes, indeed. I am of Irish extraction.
Oh.
My Irish antecedents, however, came over 160 years ago. They came over in the late 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still there. In New England, there are so many Irish Americans that as was my case, my mother's background had been entirely Irish-American, and so my father's as well. So that mm-hmm. there's a kind of staying together, and we are Catholics, and therefore there was a tendency, that's breaking down, as it is in so many denominations, for Catholics to marry Catholics, and indeed, in Worcester, Massachusetts, where I grew up, there was a tendency for Irish Catholics to marry Irish Catholics. And if a boy made eyes at an Italian-American girl, that was not necessarily what was thought to be okay. That's particularly my father's generation, but in my generation as well, it was not really the way to go.